This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Another episode of First Edition already. How about that? Today on the show, Xochitl Gonzalez, the author of Anita De Monte Laughs Last, out now. Recent Reese Witherspoon book pick, so it might be blowing up your socials right now, joins me to debut a couple of new segments. I'm trying to figure out a way to talk to authors that I would like to both do the interviews and listen to the interviews. So two segments. One, it's called Anatomy of the Scene. We both picked a scene from the book to talk about, get into it, and see how it relates to the rest of the book. The second segment is called Easiest and Hardest, in which she tells me about a couple of the pieces of the book that were both the easiest to write and the hardest to write. The goal here is to be a good listen, whether or not you've read the book. So let me know if I succeeded. FirstEdition@bookriot.com. Thanks so much for listening, and let's get into it.
Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Leigh Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, and so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high-stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillén Santángel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at LeighBardugoTheFamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. Let me ask you a question. How well do you think you know people? And how well do you think they know you? Six award-winning best-selling authors of suspense explore the lingering threat of secrets and the inescapable fear that they can't stay buried forever. So no matter how dark the hiding place, the consequences of revealing the truth can bring out the worst in lovers, friends, family, and strangers. And check this out. You can read and listen to all six short stories in the Never Tell collection free with Prime. You can learn more at amazon.com/nevertell. And these best-selling authors include Liv Constantine, Laurith Ann White, Andrea Bartz, Rachel Housel Hall, Avi Pachoda, and Carolyn Kepnes. Again, you can read and listen to all six short stories free with Prime and also Kindle Unlimited. So make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode.
All right. So I have Xochitl Gonzalez with me to talk about bits and pieces of her novel that will be out by the time you're listening to this, Anita De Monte Laughs Last. And I was telling her before this episode that this is my first attempt with some new structures. So listeners out there will know, and I'm hoping that she will be entertained and edified by the games I'm trying to play here and see how it goes. And also, listeners, right, did you like these segments? How did it go? I'm trying to make something that authors interested in doing, I like to do, and then is interesting to listen to as well. So the first thing we're going to do, I'm calling Anatomy of a Scene. We've both picked a scene from the book to use as a lens to talk about the broader themes of the book, what it's like, and how it came to be. So, Chill, is that what you were expecting to do here in the next 20 minutes?
Yes, and I'm excited about it, and okay. I think it's going to be great.
You are one of the world's great sports for saying so. Okay, so I've already done a synopsis at the top of the show, and the first scene we're going to talk about is one I've picked, and it is an account. It's a scene where one of the protagonists, the protagonist of the book, maybe even worth talking about in its own way, Raquel Toro, who is a junior at Brown. Is that right? She's a junior at this point?
Yeah, it's like the summer between her junior and her senior year. Yeah.
Which is an interesting time, right? You're thinking about the future, but you're not done yet. You still got some meat on the college bone.
Yes.
And she's going in to talk to a professor who has been her mentor up to this time, who is studying an artist named, and she's approaching him about studying an artist named Jack Martin, who is also his, I don't know, academic muse or subject of long time. And the reason I picked this was the power dynamics are interesting between a student and professor at large. And then Raquel and Professor Temple also have their own dynamic. And I'm going to throw it to you a little bit to talk about, who are these characters and what are they doing in this scene together?
Yeah. So, you know, John Temple's, I think one of the things that was fun when writing this was it was fun to regress myself in age and remember how people my age, where I feel relatively young, like I'm 47, and to a young person in college seem really old. So, you know, in the department to peers, in the art history department, he's like the hot shot, kind of like Jack Martin scholar. And, you know, and Jack Martin's like up there with like Dan Flavin, or like it's like being like a Pollock scholar, you know, like it's relatively edgy for the canon, quote unquote, you know. And so he is used to, he's good looking, he kind of knows it, you know, and it's like the girls that are younger can't tell if they think he's good looking or gross, you know, but they're like, so he just, you know, he smokes Dunhills. He has like mid-century modern furniture. Like he inexplicably, like a lot of people at Brown, he inexplicably has high quality, or any Ivy League really, high quality furniture and goods. And yet you're like, but you're on a faculty salary. I don't understand. But, you know, to Raquel, when she first meets him and she sees him during the year, it's like he embodies the Ivy League, you know?
Right.
And now it's like the best way to put this, he summoned her to his office because he found some things that she might need for her thesis, but it's the end of the year. It's like the right before Memorial Day weekend, and he's kind of packing things up and she's just stopping in, you know, for a little office visit, but classes are over. So it's a little bit less formal than maybe some of their other encounters. And then Raquel is like mildly changed because she's about 3 or 4 weeks into this like whirlwind relationship with this hotshot artist on campus. And she doesn't think it's been affecting her, but then it kind of totally has, you know, she's really been this like eager, I'd say nerdy student, eager to please and like get, you know, like be sort of, you know, blessed and said like, oh yes, anointed, like you're one of my favorites, you're doing great. And now suddenly she's got a little bit of swagger to her when she approaches him because she feels emboldened by this relationship and what it must say about her that this like kind of hot shoddy artist guy who's like a celebrity in this part of the school in a small campus and a smaller, even smaller pond, he's a big fish, right?
That's interesting you mentioned that, because one of the things that's happening is she has a critical consciousness in her own way before this point, but
yes,
she's understanding what that, you know, what the consequence of that is in all facets of her life, and then how she can use it, who she can use it with, against, and for eventually, right? Because as you say, like up until this moment, he is a figure for her of no critique, essentially. He's a professor.
That's right.
She comes to him, you know, it was sort of intellectual supplication, like many of us did at 18, 19, 20, when we wanted to do well and we needed a recommendation. Like, I think one thing the book is especially keen on is the sort of the academic currencies, right? Of recommendations and nominations and fellowships and grades, of course, but even above grades, right? This is the level above grades where it's about, do they like you well enough to think of you when a thing comes up to think of you for?
Yes. Yeah. And it really makes you realize, you know, when you start looking at it that way, it makes you realize how important the sort of tap system is.
Yes.
Like once you kind of cross, you know, one of the things that's great about, people were like, why did you keep it at brown? And I was like, because we have a literal gate that we walk through when we get there. And it's like they literally open the gate on the first day.
Do you have to show an ID? Like, do you have to get onto the campus?
No,
is it one
like,
of those?
You, okay. No, it's like, it's metaphorical. There's right. There are these big gates. And then on the first day of your freshman year, they open them up and all the freshmen walk through. And then on commencement, all the alumni walk through before you, and then the graduates walk through. And then you walk past all the graduates that came before you. And it's like the only, besides campus dance, and most traditional thing that we do at Brown. But I think when you're thinking about a book about gatekeeping, right. It was hard to get past the gate that lives in my head, the Van Wickle gates. So, you know, she's really... Yeah, it's like, it's just, once you get past there's still a whole other system of tapping right. that kind of happens that I think, you know, she's been so worried she won't be available to her to some extent. She sees how the system works, but she's worried that she's not of the system enough to like,
That's so interesting.
Up until this moment, it's like, it's her first time feeling like, well, maybe there's other paths. You know, she's kind of seen John Temple as her only path, like through this man's approval, I will be able to move forward. And now like there's a little bit more looseness around that.
I've got some other angles of attack, right? Maybe I can come at this differently.
And I don't know how long that lasts, that sense of security, but in that moment, she's feeling it.
And it's just enough, because like the first line of this chapter is John Temple's office was a mess. In fact, Raquel realized John Temple himself, or not himself, Ida, that was a bit of a mess. So like the office is a manifestation, or just, you know, if you're a mess, sometimes the desk is the first thing to go. Even people that are pretty well put together, I like to think I am, and my desk is a wreck. But just enough leverage or just enough change in her power dynamic was enough to see it from a different angle. And that's a thorough line in a lot of different things that happen here in the rest of the book as well. I want to ask you about Temple, because one of my least favorite tropes, and part of it is because as a former last academic, I saw it firsthand in ways that were not fun, of the professor-student relationship. And this borders on that. And she's wondering, and I think some of the, there's this other clique that she isn't, she's not a part of the art girls clique, but she's sort of an auxiliary to their clique. Is at one point he asked her out for coffee in a later scene, and she's like, was that a pass that they were talking about, or was it not? Is he doing these nice things to me that he doesn't have to do, give me this folder full of interesting stuff because he wants to take me to bed or something that's going to happen? But he also cares about things. He's not a monster. And there's this really great, I don't know if you'd call it monologue, where he's talking about influence and change over time. And that seemed to me not a critique of him or the system necessarily, but kind of a, I don't know. I mean, can you talk your own relationship to the words that come out of his mouth in this scene?
Yeah. You know, I'm so happy we're talking about John Temple, because I don't feel like he comes up too much, and I love him as a character. You know, I think there's sort of two aging men in this book, like predominantly aging men. And it's like John Temple, who we soon find out in this particular scene is in the middle of getting a divorce, right? And Raquel immediately qualifies him in her 20-year-old brain as sad divorcing guy, which I just was like, I remember being like, oh, that's so sad, you know, like not like it's just a fact.
Has like a mental model of what that character is herself.
That looks like. Yeah. And then I think she sees him near like this depressing like apartment building complex. She's like, that must be a sad divorce house. it's like this narrative that suddenly took shape. But, and then the other kind of aging guy is Jack Martin, who in his own storyline, you come to find out, has gone through some troubles due to his insecurities and violence upon acting about them. And I think that there's something about, like, you know, there's so much in the media about how women feel about aging, and I think not enough about how men feel about aging and this idea of relevancy. And so a lot of that monologue where he's talking about kind of how art history has always worked, and like how art movements have worked, not so much art history, but how art movements have worked from, you know, artists themselves. And then he sort of puts himself in it, and just being young and being at boarding school and watching like the tumult of the 60s and the civil rights movement, and being so attracted to this sculptural movement that Jack Martin was a part of because it seemed to make sense of like a complicated world, you know, and how that made him feel edgy. Like it made him, and then suddenly in having this conversation with Raquel, because it happens a little later in the book, he almost realizes like, oh, I've become the person I was trying to revolt
That's
against.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Like, so I think like sometimes, you know, when it's like, well, is he gross or is he good? I think he's mainly good. But I think that there is these moments where you feel your fleeting age. And I don't think it's completely out of bounds to say that there has been a history of men trying to make themselves feel younger through women.
Right.
Like through younger women or younger men. But youth being like maybe that youth can be contagious. And so I think that there's these moments where his own is, you know, maybe he's had a couple too many glasses of wine or whatever. And he's like, I don't know. He's like, what, you want to get coffee? And like, and it's like, yeah, no. And it's like, probably for the best.
Probably best. Yeah. No.
Yeah. But I think he's mainly good. You know, I think he's mainly good. I think Jack represents sort of the other side where that insecurity and that fear of relevance that comes, you know, the inevitable irrelevance that we have, particularly in this country, that seems to come with age. Like he's so frightened of it that it drives him to much more monstrous things than a coffee invitation. So
And you know, it's interesting too, as someone who's taught in not a setting like this, but I was at Columbia for a while and I had undergraduate students, and like, even as, you know, 26, 27, you're 8 or 9 years old different, and you realize you're on the other side of the power divide, right?
Totally.
And it's a completely strange dynamic, and it's fraught and exciting in its own way. And it can be very mutually beneficial. And I don't want to focus on them so much as, except to say, is like, this is, you have these characters and institutions in these places to show in this particular, but in general, like, here are the places that a person like Raquel is up against, or a person like Anita is up against, and they have to navigate these people. Those people are navigating them, right?
Yeah.
John Temple is not thinking about navigating Raquel in the same way that Raquel, and it can be, it's true in many power dynamics. Like, even with a young, you know, white male student, they're navigating a power dynamic in office hours that I wasn't navigating when I was teaching or something else like that. And it's doubly and triply fraught for reasons.
Yeah.
And I guess one of the things that happens, it's interesting, like, where does the crack in the system come from? I think that's another thing that's interesting. Like, how does so Raquel is, I can't remember, is it Anita's language or is it Raquel's language, the third world at third world?
So it was, it's actually both of their languages.
Oh, okay. Well,
no, it's both of the languages.
Confused,
it was a term that was used in the 70s for kind of minority peoples. And it was meant to be an empowering term. And it just so happened that that was what, you know, Anna Mendieta, who was the artist that inspired Anita DeMonte, she was part of that scene and movement, considered part of that third world artist scene. And then at Brown, which is, I used my real college, our student center was called the Third World Center.
Right.
And it was third world orientation. And like, you know, and I remember just being like, this seems insane. Like,
And it kind of gets co-opted ironically or not a little bit.
Co-opted ironically. Yeah. No, totally. And it's completely changed since then. But like, you know, I thought it was actually just amongst many coincidences that seemed to tie the way that they saw the world, but also how it had changed, right? Like it was like Anita lived in the time where it was empowering, and Raquel lived in the time where it was kind of like, oh yeah, like
a little shaggy, a little shaggy, yeah. Because the other thing that happens in this is she doesn't know it, but she gets put on a path towards a different understanding because she's going to be put in the place of a different mentor and the curator at a different, slightly less prestigious than maybe some of the other museums she could get a fellowship with. Belinda Kim, who is a generation older than her, a woman of color with a different sensibility, different understanding, and a different set of importance on Jack's biographical details. But she gets put in the path of someone who can, I guess, mold is not right, because there's a word when Raquel performs moldability, and that's something that I think you put explicitly in the test.
Yeah.
But then Belinda says, well, you don't have to mold necessarily. There's another way of doing that. And it's because she didn't get the internship at the fanciest place, right? Like, there's a little crack there.
Yeah.
And there's like certain other spaces that she inhabits, like the radio station.
Yeah.
Like, it's a little off the beaten path. So there's a little bit of room for friction and putting up against there.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the things I wanted to give her access to was some spaces where she actually feels comfortable.
Yeah.
Like, and I think that at, you know, in the halls of Brown and John Temple's office, she feels like there's one way to be.
Yeah.
And then it was like at the station, and I think with Belinda, there's like a little bit of space to put her hair, you know, let her hair down. And some of that is in letting, seeing other people be fully who they are. That's outside of that bind, right? So, but I think, you know, I think it's like, she's doing this one, like kind of off brand day of the radio station. And like, it's not like, it's like for 6 days a week, it's an alternative rock station. And they give one day to every form of Black music, right? And then, you know, the radio, like she's like, at this, like, it's a small little museum and they do good things, but you know, she's not, it's not having to go and perform at like, you know, like the Met, as like, I think she probably would not have found as much of a voice for herself. Right. And I think at the end of the day, you know, she sort of also finds a kind of alternative career path originally,
right.
That's not exactly confining her to those things. And it gave her room for some choice. It's like, well, if I have to act that way, then I don't think I want to do it that way. Right. And that was kind of nice. I don't think she saw it. That wasn't what she was going for there. I think at the radio station, she's looking for breathing space. And I think with Belinda, she found those alternative routes.
Yeah.
And that like was empowering to her. Yeah.
And totally, when she gets at her most sort of sucked up into the glamour or the good life or the, you know, having the skull and bones key metaphorically to Brown.
Yeah.
One of the first things that drops away is her time at the radio station and doing these open mics, and she gets called out on it by a friend, right?
Yeah.
Like it's kind of not a surprise. Like if you're going to get sucked up by the powers that be and the wine and cheese,
yeah,
it's not a surprise that those spaces you start to either implicitly, explicitly, those things become marginalized in your own life because you have these other spaces that you're inhabiting and this other avenue you're exploring consciously or not.
But, you know, there was one thing that I did do purposely because it was something that I just wanted to complicate things with a little bit, which is I do make you meet her family, Raquel's family, and they kind of hold this point of view that she's sort of always been a bit of a snob. So I think that I thought it was really important to me. That, and she herself passes these little judgments about like some of her sister's behaviors and things. And I thought it was actually important to me that as much as you have empathy for her in these situations where she doesn't feel enough, like she found her way to that school somewhat for a reason. Like
she's a gold star student.
Like,
she's a gold star student. Yeah,
she's totally like so, you know, it's like in her own way, she is also like she wanted to push herself into some of those corners, but then was like, all right, this is a little too far. So we're watching almost the result of her own self experiment with distance, I'd say, like, right, like distance traveled. And that was kind of fun to do, but I thought, I don't know, it was really important for me to, for us to meet her family and just also see like when she feels uncomfortable, what is that coming? Like, what was it that she's running away from that now she finds so comforting?
Right. Yeah. Well, and I think that, you know, dealing with the consequences and then maybe recoiling from the consequence of making a Faustian bargain with the man or power structures is maybe a useful transition to talking about Anita and the scene you wanted to talk about, right?
Oh,
is that reasonable?
Yeah. No, I think that that's a great transition. And now, of course, I'm just riding back to find it. And so in this scene, it's Anita, the titular Anita DeMonte, who's an artist. And she has she goes with her husband, who's, well, at that time, they're not quite married yet. And she goes to an art opening for him. It's a mid-career retrospective, his third. it's important to know.
A lot of keeping
third.
Score of how many mid-career retrospectives you have. That's an important currency.
There's an important currency. And, you know, and so she had turned down, we find out that she's in a bit of a bad mood about the whole thing because she had turned down a fellowship of her own to join him while he installed this big exhibit. And he promised that things were going to be different there. And then as soon as they get to the opening, he sort of back to his old tricks of like introducing her as his girlfriend and not giving her credit for what she does. And, you know, she had come on Peter Pan and it, like from Cuba, and she hates talking about it, and he loves talking about it because it makes them seem so interesting. And so he's sort of turned her into cocktail conversation, and she's kind of stormed off. And his gallerist comes to confront her in the bathroom, and she's like putting on her lipstick, and she says, "Oh, you know, like one of the reasons why when I read it again, I know I wrote it, but then later I was like, that was really kind of a good line."
Let's do it.
She goes, I'm just going to read this little tiny part. She said, "The door to the restroom opened and it was Tilly carrying a drink. Hi there," she said. "I thought you might need this." "Thank you," I set it on the counter and reapplied my lipstick. "You look very fetching, Anita." She sounded sincere. I was about to thank her when she added, "That dress was made for you. Is that a Dior?" "Halston," I said flatly. My antenna went up. Tilly knows a Halston from a fucking Dior. Jack has a woman at Bergdorf who helps him pick things. He'd mentioned it. So I just, like, and this sort of sets this thing up where she, a seeming, and I think that's a lot of Anita's dilemma, where a seeming act of kindness, actually, if you're not paying enough attention, is actually an act of aggression or manipulation. And Jack has like a team, so it's not just him. He's sending in people.
Yeah.
So she's like, you know, as soon as she sees the woman, she's like, "Is this going to be fine?" And then she's like, "No, it is not." And so she knows what this is going to be, and she kind of like steals herself up for a bit of a tete-a-tete, you know. And then the rest of the scene is her kind of, you know, Tilly sort of saying to her, "You don't, Jack doesn't care if you're an artist. You care about how he introduces you, but he doesn't care that you're an artist." She's like, "But I care that I'm an artist." And I think this idea, you know, one of the reasons why I was, you know, as I said, it was inspired by the story of Ana Mendieta, who died in 1985. And one of the reasons why I was very drawn to keeping it period in both places and not bringing it forward is because I think we sometimes forget how new feminism is.
Right.
And how in 1985 and even in 1998, it wasn't considered a bad thing to just sort of be like, "Well, now I met a guy who makes a lot of money and I'm not as successful and I'll just stay home." Like, you know, and like, and that it was considered obnoxious almost to not find that enough.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and that it was, you know, she seemed ungrateful or she seemed difficult. And, you know, and I think even with Raquel, like, you know, a generation later, she kind of meets this well-off guy, and it's like, "Well, do I need to be my own person, or can I just be in support?" Like, that also is, I'm sort of seeing that that's also by some considered valid. And like, I think that it's interesting for us to not forget how contemporarily
right,
we've been dealing with and still trying to answer some of these questions.
Yeah, because even Belinda later sort of marks herself as being as a slightly different generation than Raquel, saying like, I didn't even realize that I could be doing something different with my own scholarship, right? Like, she sort of like was a, I'm not
that's
as good,
right.
with, but she's like, "Oh, wait, there are different, you have younger eyes, you have a different generational eyes." And like, feminism wasn't the same for everyone for sure. But even like 10 years before Raquel, someone who would consider herself a feminist with a overtly feminist project still is fighting with a certain kind of blindness.
I mean, I will say this, like, I remember, and even not even around feminism, but just it's still, we forget how much change has happened just in society. Like, I remember Sam Chang saying at the workshop how people told her, like, "You'll never have a career if you insist on publishing these stories about Chinese people."
Mm.
And then, like, I even Christina Enriquez, whose book has a book coming out,
That's
The Great
right.
Divide, which is wonderful. She graduated in like 2003 from the workshop and told me that she felt like it was very shunned upon to write about identity in any capacity. Like, you know, like you were sort of just put these, a human going through an experience, like unrelated to how they exist in the world.
Mm.
And so I think we forget how new some of these conceits and concepts and grapplings are. And so, but for me, a lot of it, I think I love this idea that two women that are both, one is successful. Tilly, when she comes into that bathroom, is a very successful art dealer. And she's kind of like feels completely confident in saying, like, "Your desire for success is getting in my client's way of happiness." Like,
She's the cultural Luca Brasi. Like she comes in, it's like, you know, your career's going to swim with the fishes if you don't shut up and stop dancing drunk on tables.
Yeah, she's totally the cultural Luca Brasi. And like, and it's such a great analogy. And like, and at the same time, like, but not ready to swallow her own ambitions.
No,
like,
no.
But I think, you know, Tilly is another character that I just love because she just ended up being way more complicated. And yeah. Like, you know, in my mind, I always imagined her being like, yes, but I wasn't trying to have a relationship. Like, you know, like justify, like, she's like, but I'm not trying to be with one of the greatest artists of a generation. So I leave me alone. Like,
right. Yeah. And she comes up later. We find that she, Jack is, I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but Jack is the antagonist in a lot of ways of what goes on in the book.
Yes.
But Tilly is a sergeant at arms and she comes up again later, right? She comes up again to be an important figure for Raquel to contend with, at least orthogonally, right? And that the and how those, I don't know if you call it soft power or hard power or slush money or whatever you call it, but those are the places, those even exceed the literal gates of Brown or the literal passing on of fellowships. Like this is the final boss of supremacy is people like Tilly with connections and money and no scruples.
Yeah. But you know, it's funny because I will say this when I, in my first book, I wrote a scene after Hurricane Maria, and it was like with a bunch of kind of like corporate executives and, you know, wealthy financiers in the island of Puerto Rico. And people were like, that was this villainous, ghoulish scene. And I was like, it was kind of taken out of a Fortune article. Like it was like a like, you know, I was like, that was like more people that do cryptocurrency. But, you know, I was like the sentiments exist in the real world. And I think in general, one of my preoccupations is like writing power, you know, and like, and I think it's not unfound. Like, I think the things that are the scariest sometimes about my fiction are the things that kind of are a little bit true.
Well, I think that's, I mean, like, these high powered art dealers, like we have real world examples of the, of these that like, what's the most empathetic portrayal of an art dealer I can think of? Ain't many.
Not many. I think like Gauguin's brother in the Willem Dafoe movie comes across okay. But like that I think might be one of the only
ones. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that, you know, as a go-between, because so much of it is it's connections and networking at the highest level,
and
right?
and navigating the perception of value. Right. Like and that means how do you change the perception of value except by manipulating the way things are perceived.
That's right.
So, you know, I think that it's one of the dark arts. It's one of the darker arts. That's all right.
But we all need a fixer like that. I mean, also I could use a Tilly fixer. I'd make it into another valuable fixer too.
I know. I sort of dug that she was a deeply intuitive woman, you know, but she just used her powers in a very particular way. But she tied herself to that boat, right? Like she's this is my boat. So, you know, I've got to keep it floating.
I was thinking about like, you know, people do like an altered angle version, like a version of, I guess, not maybe this story, because it's mostly Raquel that we follow through, of like her sitting in the rooms. There's a trial. And again, I'm not spoiling it. Tilly I wonder what her own internal monologue was in those rooms. Was she like, this is fine and I'm just doing what I got to do? Or was there some sort of internal remove of like, okay, this is an asshole, but
I don't know. In my mind, I think it's like, he's an asshole, but it's my asshole. Yeah. But I wonder, you know, I mean, I wonder how things like that played out in real life. And honestly, it was because that character came to me mainly because in thinking about how this was sort of inspired by a real life story, I was intrigued by that person. Like, I was like, you know, if I did something terribly nefarious tomorrow, how would my agent act?
Yeah, right. Yeah, totally.
Great. Like I'm just like, you know, like, do you just sort of turn a blind eye? Do you stand by their side? Like, what do you do? And I thought that was an interesting thing to kind of look at, at least, you know, it was interesting to me anyway. Yeah.
Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle. Walk, Ride, Paddle is a captivating memoir of Senator Tim Kaine's physical journey through the Virginia wilderness, but it is also a unique and ultimately optimistic perspective on these pivotal moments in history, offering inspiration, wisdom, and hope. With immediacy and honesty, Kaine pulls back the curtain to reveal his inner thoughts during such monumental times. And Kaine's storytelling gift and wise observations offer a fascinating glimpse into the mind of a seasoned politician and outdoor enthusiast. Walk, Ride, Paddle is available everywhere audiobooks are sold on April 9th. It is narrated and written by Tim Kaine, Virginia senator and former Democratic vice presidential candidate. It's a compelling account of one man's journey across hundreds of miles of Virginia wilderness and a moving testament to the optimistic spirit of America. So make sure to check out Walk, Ride, Paddle by Tim Kaine. And thanks again to Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Taming Seven is an epic and unforgettable love story in the international best-selling and TikTok phenomenon The Boys of Tommen series from Chloe Walsh. So Tommen's cheekiest lad, Jared Gibbsy Gibson, has always been a comedian, but inside he is haunted by events of the past and he uses humor to cope, hiding his true self from the world. Then you have Claire Biggs, who is the epitome of sunshine. She's always loved Gibbsy, her brother's friend and her favorite neighbor. She also has always seen a side to him that no one else seems to notice, and she becomes determined to tame her wild at heart childhood best friend. So the Boys of Tommen series is an internationally best-selling YA romance series that has taken TikTok by storm. It's perfect for readers looking for new adult slash crossover romance, dual point of views, friends to lovers, marathon-worthy TikTok books, and angsty tearjerkers. Taming Seven is published today, and it's the fifth book in the series, so make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode.
We're going to do the scenes that we found the easiest or hard, the bits and pieces. We can do it whichever way you want to do it. So
okay.
I'll cut this little piece out. I can prompt you however you want. You want to start with the easiest one, the hardest one? How would you like to begin?
They're weirdly both Anita scenes. So
okay, let's go.
Start with the easiest.
All right, let's start with the easiest. Okay, we're back. The next gimmick. Did that work, the anatomy of a scene? I thought we got something out of that.
I think that was fun.
We had a good time.
Yeah, I think that was fun. We'll see.
It brings me back to my close reading days, which I cannot get enough of. I don't know if anyone else cares, but I enjoy
it. I miss them. I miss that. Yeah.
So the next gimmick is for Zochil to talk to us about a bit that she found easiest and a bit she found more difficult. And they seem to be same. Sounds like they maybe are a size of the same coin or double-edged sword, or we're going to start with the easiest, the came the most naturally that flowed right out.
Well, and I'm actually, it turns into sort of the same answer. The naturalist thing was the beginning of the whole book. That I wrote that in one sitting in one night, like, and I barely changed it, like very little changed over different iterations. Like, I think the first draft was third person about how it opens on Anita, like at this party. And it's like, if the line was the same, if it weren't for what happened later, everyone would have forgotten that night entirely. Like the whole first paragraph, actually, more or less, like it was like the 70s, you know, nights when you never knew what could happen, what to expect. I don't know, that just sort of poured out. And it was like how I saw the party, how I saw her like engagement in it, how I wanted you to meet them. Like, I really wanted you, like I had workshopped something with Jamel Brinkley at Iowa, and he was like, you do a really good job of dropping us into conflict. And I was like, I want to drop us right in the midst of a conflict.
In flagrante, flagrante in this vibe.
Yeah, but I think I would say then I realized how easy it was, because when I had to start the next section, which was how you meet Raquel, that was terribly hard. And it wasn't so much that I rewrote it as much as I had to kind of cut probably like 60 pages to get to the version that we are at. Now, there was just so much more I wanted us to see about her life. But then I realized I had to worry about how the book works. Like, you know, you can't, you're like, I need to give you just enough for it to work as a book and not for it to work as the story of just Raquel. And I think that was a growing pain from Olga, where I let myself just indulge in letting you get to know Olga really, really well. Like, and Prieto, but more Olga, right? Yeah. Like, it's like, I mean, we knew what Olga, like, vitamins she took practically. Like, it was like, and then she took her Flintstone multivitamin. Like, it's like, really. So this was a challenge. But the hardest part to write of the whole book, I think, was when Anita goes back to Cuba. because I was stuck before I went. Then I was like, well, I have to go to Kuvan and then I will know how to write this. And I knew it was like a revelatory turning point in the character's own psyche. And then I wrote something and it just was so like, I don't know, it felt like corny fictional travel literature. Like it was like so
describing
like,
the color of the water
like,
and
oh,
sand and
I
stuff.
Mean, yeah, yeah, and like and people frolicking and like, you know, there was a reunion dinner with a family. And then I was like, oh my God. And I was like, why are you telling this? Like, you know, like I always like I didn't teach a lot because teaching isn't, I mean, it's so hard. I think like teaching is so hard. Like it's so, you have to give so much. But I do remember always talking about, I was like, there's so many ways to think about point of telling. It was like, we always think point, it was like, but it's like, literally sometimes it's like, but why are you telling me this? Like, right? Like, it's like,
well,
like
I can
what is
see
the
how,
actual point
I
of
can see
telling?
how that's hard because her own relationship to Cuba is fraught. Like she has one and
Yes.
doesn't, right? She like,
Yes.
or she wants to have one more than she actually has, or the loss of the possibility of a relationship
Yes.
is hanging overhead. So
Yes.
like, how do you, through her, deal with that complication? And her visit ultimately does not heal her. It is not the salvation that maybe she
No.
was hoping
And
for.
so then I really started to think about, I was thinking about why is it in the first person? And I always say like first person, it's a wide ranging theory, but first person tends to be either for coming of age or for madness. And I think in being dead, I allowed her to be mad, right? And
Spoiler
then I just,
alert. That's in the
yeah,
first.
like,
It's in the first chapter.
that's
I'm
in the
kidding.
first chapter. So it's okay. It's like a bad, like a terrible spoiler otherwise. But like, I think, you know, I was like, it's madness of two sorts. It's madness in the, you know, sort of, you know, kind of literary sense. And it's also just angriness. She's just really angry. And I thought to myself, there are so many things that I only would want to talk about. Like when I talk about like Brooklyn, for instance, I only will really talk about it with people from here. Like, and what I think in the most deep nuanced of ways, like, I'm like, it's not worth trying to talk about, like, it's going to get me more annoyed, like to try to talk about it with somebody, like, cause then I have to explain what the thing was that like, now it isn't anymore. And so I thought that finally was my solution, is that she's going to talk about Cuba in the sense that she's very aware that she's a person telling you a story. Like, right. Like she's, I was like, why am I using first person? I'm like, because she has agency over the story. She knows what she's telling you. She's telling you things for a reason. And so she can also choose to not tell you things. And so she's going to say, I went back to Cuba and I'm only going to tell you the parts that you need to know. Because if you were from Cuba, I wouldn't need to tell you this anyway. You don't need me to
Interesting.
tell you. And if I do, and then that finally felt like I wasn't writing for the sake of writing and that I was writing in the character. Yeah.
Interesting.
That was the hardest part. That was the hardest part.
I do feel like I noticed a subtle, and I didn't mark it at the time, so I don't have, you know, I can't do a close reading with evidence, a shift in her attitude to her own story right around that time. Like you could
Oh,
feel it a
yeah.
little bit about that time for sure.
Yeah. There's like a power that I think she gets back, even of just, it shifts her own way that she saw things. Well, you know, and it was funny. I had had this idea. I'd been in Iowa for a few months. And then when I guess I'd done 1 year at Iowa when I had the idea for this book. And probably I had the idea for this book because I'd known who Anna Mendieta was. But when I was in Iowa, I thought about her all the time because she'd gone to Iowa. And when I went to Cuba and I was like looking at the soil there really smells very distinct and it's very red. It's really, really minerally. I don't know. It's really beautiful. And I thought about how she buried herself in the banks of the Iowa River. And suddenly the whole thing felt really different. Like, you know, like, and I was like, oh my God. I was like, what did that mean before you came here? And then how did you see it? You know, like, and so I think when I decided to not spend it as a travelogue, it opened me up to just like, what do you need to know? And then I was able to have her have a real shift. Yeah. But by the way, I just want to say I am a big advocate for traveling to where you're writing about if you can.
Interesting.
I just think it gives gifts that you can't anticipate. Yeah.
Well, and then you get to have, and I think I lost the thread. Anita studied, was she an undergrad at Iowa? How
she
did,
was,
I put that?
She got sent to an orphanage in Iowa and
In
then
Iowa.
went, did all of her schooling there
Okay,
and then
that's what it
eventually
was.
comes to New York. So she has this little Iowa
Yeah.
But like, yeah. And I think again, like part of my obsession with this, why I was like, I have to borrow, when I'm borrowing the story, I have to keep that note of biography, because I was mind blown at the idea of a 13-year-old girl getting off of a plane from Cuba and being sent to an orphanage in Iowa, right? Like in the 1960s, like the early 60s. Like it's just crazy to think
It's
about.
wild. It
Like,
is wild to think about.
yeah.
Thank you so much to Xochitl Gonzalez for being this guinea pig, trial balloon, episode, segments. Really appreciate that. Go check out her book, Anita DeMonte, Laughs Last. You can get it everywhere books are sold. Go subscribe to the first edition newsletter. I'm actually going to start using that. I think I'm going to have some giveaways and some things to do. Check that out. Looking forward to it. And I'm going to talk to you guys again in a couple of weeks with something else. There may be a drop-in episode here and there. I'm going to commit to the first and third Thursdays. But as opportunities arise, people want to talk to me. I've got something else we might want to do. You're going to hear it here on the show. So until next time, read something great.